Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone. I'm Danny Pellegrino. Welcome to Everything Iconic. Today on the show, I have a wonderful interview, if I do say so myself, with J. Manuel, who, of course, many people remember from America's Next Top Model with Tyra Banks. Jay was the creative director in those early seasons. And let me tell you something. He spills a lot about the show. So hold on to your seats. Are people still saying hold on to your seats? We are now. I think it's a great chat. He's also got a new book out next Tuesday called The Wig, The Bitch, and The Meltdown. Before I play our interview, which I also want to remind you, you can see our interview at the new YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/DannyPellegrino and the number one. You can go watch it, like, subscribe, comment, all that stuff. But before I play the audio of the interview here, I do want to mention one thing. We lost an icon this past week. We lost The Rege, Regis Philbin, and I loved him growing up, of course. When I was growing up, he was co-hosting Live with Kathy Lee Gifford and then with Kelly Ripa, both Queens icons and legends. And he, of course, hosted Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which was so big when I was in, like, I think middle school and high school. That show was everything. And he just had such a warm and fuzzy presence on TV. I don't know. I always felt like he felt like my grandpa and a nice version of my grandpa, which, yeah, that's a tale for another time. But he was always so warm and cuddly. And I think on Live, that's a really tough gig. And I don't know if many people know this, but those opening chats they do, those aren't scripted. And so they're just going and riffing about their day and the night before. And it's hard to hold people's attention for that long every single day. I think it takes a lot. And he did it so flawlessly with KLG and Kelly Ripa, who you guys know, I just worship them. So I just want to mention that. I was upset about it. But you know, he gave us so much, and so we honor The Rege today. Now, I also want to mention you can find me on social media at Danny Pellegrino on Twitter and Instagram. And if you want any of the Everything Iconic merch, just go to everythingiconic.store. So without further ado, please enjoy my chat with J. Manuel and check out his book. Jay, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm in a great mood. It's like storming today, but I'm in a good mood.
Right. Now, I have so many questions for you. I'm so excited about the book. But my very first question, I just need to dive right into this. I had seen online, you've been doing a lot of Instagram lives and things like that. And you briefly told a story about Janice Dickinson falling asleep at the judges' table. Can you tell this story? I'm obsessed with it.
The Janice Dickinson and the judging table. That is a funny story. She did. It was during season one, I believe. Yes, it was. It was definitely during season one. And what people don't realize is those judgings take a very, very, very long time to shoot. So we'd started early in the day and it was, you know, season one, everything takes longer. It went very long. And I think at dinner, she might have had some wine. And so when they were ready to, you know, that night we shot to like almost 3 a.m. So when they wanted to shoot, she was asleep and they said, oh, let's just roll on a tighter shot till she wakes up kind of deal.
So you guys shot on Top Model. You just shot around her while she was taking a little nap. I love that.
We did that night. Yeah.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. Now, Jay, what have you been up to during the quarantine and all of this stuff? Do you watch a lot of TV? Do you read a lot of books? Like, what are you up to?
You know, honestly, I love movies actually even more than TV shows, but there are several TV shows that I do enjoy just because of the story. They tend to be on like a lot of the streaming platforms. This quarantine, though, it was just kind of very crazy timing. My book was always supposed to announce in May, and there's, you know, lots to do, you know, final preparations and like marketing stuff and, you know, just all the, I did not know how much everyone says writing a book is a lot of work. That's actually the easier part. It's all the stuff that comes after. So I've been luckily very, very busy at home. And when I kind of need a break, especially Fridays, I don't miss Drag Race because it's like, that just brings me kind of fun in the week. But yeah, I've been mostly just working on this stuff, doing the Instagram lives, trying to catch up with family and friends over like FaceTime and stuff like this and Zoom. So I haven't had a lot of time to watch TV.
Now,
to be honest with you.
The book, tell people a little bit about it. So it's a fictional book. Tell people about it.
Yeah, well, yeah. So the very definition of a novel is that it's fiction. And it is. It is a complete work of fiction. But, you know, when you write something like this, we write what we know in terms of kind of our experiences. So it is inspired by my life in the industry and my life on America's Next Top Model. But for people who want to read this book, you don't have to have watched the show. Even if you've never seen an episode, the book is perfect for that reader because I kind of set up the world. The show is called Model Muse within my book, the kind of the model competition show. And so I set up that world before the main story even takes hold. And I wanted this to be, you know, I kind of set out to write something that had this metafictional kind of mechanism in place towards the end of the book in the last third, because I wanted readers to kind of, I wanted them to feel the lines being blurred and breaking the fourth wall so that they're kind of thrust back out into their own world to kind of look at themselves and maybe see some of the kind of more important core themes that I had in the book. Because the book is a piece of satire. It's meant to be fun. But I had these themes that were very important to me, you know, from looking at like how the entertainment industry deals with abuse of power, how do we kind of find ways to kind of, equalize that balance in the workplace, to also looking at kind of how the industry deals with intersectionality and Black women's identity and the cost of fame and all of that. So those are kind of like, that's the gravitas to the piece, but the book is meant to be just fun and laugh and clutch your pearls and kind of talk at it from time to time.
Right. It's so fun. And you mentioned sort of the diving back into that world a little bit, and you mentioned your Instagram lives, and I know you've been talking a lot about Top Model and that kind of thing. Has it been weird to go back in time a little bit and think about some of the things that happened and your experiences there?
Yeah, you know, so interestingly enough, you know, doing these kind of Jay's chats on Fridays on the Instagram Live really was an idea that was kind of born, you know, because when the quarantine started, people started binge watching, you know, these nostalgic older shows, and there's a whole new audience experiencing America's Next Top Model for the first time. Side note, I cringe when I even look at some of that footage and what we're wearing, and it's like the stuff's from 2003. Right. But you know, there was just all this kind of hype. It became a big binge watch show on Amazon and Hulu. And so, you know, Miss J initially said to me, she's like, you know, everyone's asking me to do these lives. We should do a live and break down a season a week. And I said, sure. I thought it would be fun to kind of talk about it and relive it. And ironically, I'm reliving a little more of the experience of Top Model than when I was writing the book. Because I wrote the book over, you know, a few years. And the other thing too is those characters took on a life of their own, and it is fiction. So watching this now and talking about it is a bit surreal.
Right. And you mentioned it being in the news, or it being sort of people binge watching it again, and it has made news about some of the cringier moments. And I know you've addressed that a bit already, but I'm curious if you have any other thoughts or response to some of the stuff that has come back up again. Specifically, there was like a blackface challenge, and there were some comments.
Well, it wasn't called the blackface challenge.
Forgive me. Sorry. Right. Yeah. Right. Right.
I know what you're talking about, right. Though. Yeah, the specifically, I think what people were looking at was in cycle 4, I believe, where we were the original creative for the shoot was like this supposed to be just like a Got Milk like shoot. And the girls, originally the way it was written up, the girls were going to be holding, you know, crying babies. And then there was kind of complications around trying to do that. So that girls ended up holding dolls. And then there was this layer added to the shoot was saying that it would be a great opportunity for the girls to understand what it's like to be a different race. So they swapped races. I have talked about it because it has come up. I was extremely uncomfortable at the time. And there was a kind of shift in culture behind the scenes of the show. It was shifting quickly. The show had really taken off. And so I did go to my co-executive producer, who's who I felt the most comfortable with at the time, and said, you know, I don't think I can represent on camera doing this shoot because, you know, I think I'm going to end up wearing this. I did not feel comfortable with that layer of creative. And I also did not feel comfortable kind of taking that further up in the chain to say, guys, we can't do this, because other producers had stepped forward saying, we shouldn't do this. And they were shut down in a very big way. So of course that scared me to say anything. And my producer, the producer that I went to, said, well, you've got to do the shoot. Don't worry. We'll edit it. You won't look bad. And I did call my parents. You know, my parents grew up in South Africa under apartheid. You know, it was very difficult for me to kind of process what we were doing and what that meant in, within the history of this country. But it was not a place where I could speak up really at right. the time. Yeah, it was difficult.
One of the things that's interesting about the time that we're living in now and kind of going back and looking at so many of the things from the past is that I think that people sometimes don't realize there's a lot of people making those decisions on sets. It's not just one person. And mm-hmm. and not you had mentioned not feeling maybe empowered enough to speak up even more against it. And I think... I don't know. That's just something to take note of, because I find that online, oftentimes people place the blame on one person. And
yeah,
and, I don't know. Switching gears a bit, do you have a favorite contestant?
Oh gosh, that's so hard. I have so many, many favorites, and that's the truth. You know, I spend so much time with the girls. Like a photo shoot day could be 14, 15 hours. And then I obviously have makeovers and I, these challenges and stuff. So I spend so much time with them, and there are girls that I connect with on a personal level who might not necessarily would have been the best model. And when I'm on the photo shoot, I'm always there to get everyone, make sure everyone has a good photo. But I've connected with so many of the girls. It's so hard to choose a favorite. But if I'm going to go on just ability in terms of modeling, you know... Again, that's tricky, and I'm going to go against the norm, you know, of what the show is really about, which is, you know, some of the girls who didn't win, you know, went on and had huge careers. We look at Yaya, we look at Anna Lee, you know, who's, you know, this big actress. But then, I mean, even Eva, who did win, you know, went on and had a big career. So, you know, I just am so happy that I got to see and work with, you know, these young women as they were stepping out into their careers. So I don't really have like a favorite, although Anne from season 3 would probably punch me if I didn't say her, because her and I are still friends to this day. So I guess I'll say Anne.
Did you watch, you mentioned Eva, did you watch The Real Housewives of Atlanta at all?
I didn't. I haven't watched since she has been on. So I can't even comment about,
You mentioned working with all of these women, but you were one of the very few prominent gay men on television at the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember watching you as a kid and of course thinking,
did you
oh
say
my
as
God.
A kid, so now I'm old.
Well, no. No, but I think you influenced so many young gay men like myself just being visible on television. Did you feel any of that pressure, or were you just there to do your job? Does that make sense?
I know. No, that makes a lot of sense. And I've heard that from several people, and I'm glad that they could kind of see me as like, oh wow, you know, he's on television, he's gay, he's just doing his job. I always looked at my job on America's Next Top Model as I'm just doing me, because, you know, I kind of was always raised that way. I you know, because in many respects, it's weird because I'm biracial. People think I'm Spanish, but like I was never really, for some people, I wasn't black enough to be black. I'm not white. And so I kind of was just, my parents always raised me just to be me. So when, you know, I became a part of the show, I just thought, well, I'm just going to do the best job I can. But I love that there, I've heard many stories from people saying, wow, I watched you and I knew that I could do this or do that or be an influencer. And I did talk about this is something people don't know. There were times where I felt it was important to talk about my sexuality, which I've never really done before. And I did it on the show, especially with contestants like Kim, where I said to her, you know, what you're doing and at your age, I could never have done at your age, and how you're like, I was basically trying to explain to her how she was a role model to me because of just looking at what she was doing. But that was always cut out. And I don't know if that was ever intentional or not, but you know, I'm glad that I could kind of be that for several people.
Right. It's frustrating that it was cut out, but I thank you because I remember watching as just a closeted gay boy in Ohio, and yeah.
Oh, cool.
Were you on set for the Tiffany moment, the Be Quiet Tiffany?
I wasn't on camera, but I absolutely was in the judging room when that went down.
Okay. So Jay, take me through, like, what were you feeling watching it? Like, what were you laughing? Were you cringing? Like, what was the vibe?
Oh no. I noticed my book is called The Meltdown. The main title part is The Meltdown, which by the way, in my book, there is a chapter called Meltdown. It's in where the main story is. And I'll say it is absolutely, I mean, I can't deny it. It is inspired by that moment with very different circumstances around, for sure. That moment was freaked everybody out. I know for a fact, Nigel has said to me, he says still to this moment, if he ever sees that clip, it's a little moment of like, kind of like PTSD for him, I guess. Like, you know, he gets goosebumps because it was scary. It was, I mean, I certainly had known Tyra for years and we had a friendship and before Top Model. I'd never really seen a moment like that. And my opinion of that moment, because there are a lot of factors that kind of created that moment, I didn't see Tiffany's reaction as it played out in real time, not edited reality time. I didn't see her reaction to what was going on as so bad. She just kind of said, okay, well, we're going home. And that's it. She hugged the girl. She said, don't cry for me. I do know Tyra has said she felt in that moment, because I'm just paraphrasing her own words, that she was so disappointed that Tiffany had given up. But that's not how Tiffany saw it. But there were so many other things going on, and that moment went way out of control. And a lot of people have talked about it, and there are articles online where there are lines, other things that were said that are not in the episode, and they weren't pleasant. And that was hard to watch. It really was.
Forgive me, I don't. So there was way more to the footage than we saw, is what you're saying.
Oh, yeah.
Is there one specific line or something that you remember that was maybe cut out? Is that an inappropriate question?
Well, it's a hard question to answer because there are, there are lines that have. I mean, there's been very reputable press that has reported other lines. I'm always very cautious about that moment because there are things that were said in the heat of that argument that are kind of burned into my mind that are really, really uncomfortable.
From Tyra.
I'll be honest. It was from her, and I was, a couple of them are reported online and they are accurate. And the reason I don't repeat them, to be honest with you, it's just like this weird sense of, honestly, it's like, what's going to come down? Right. I mean, I know this sounds strange, you know, here I'm writing this book, which again is fiction, but it is inspired by my whole experience. I know there's going to be a lot of kind of eyebrows raised around that. And it took a lot of kind of courage to even write a book that's just inspired by that experience. But there is still this odd fear of what's going to come down on you, because there was a lot of that power struggle play. There was a producer on the show that used to walk around early on to everyone on the show saying, oh, well, you know, we're all replaceable, all of us, including Tyra. So, you know, it was this sense of threat and fear. Not that because we were all doing our jobs, we loved what we did, but there was always this fear placed in front of us around our fate in the show. Everyone felt it, producers felt it. We've talked about it now. It became a very toxic environment. And I've worked on several other shows, other networks, live TV, and I've never experienced the experience that show turned into.
Why? What do you attribute that to? Was it just the people who were in charge, or?
I think it was a combination of a couple of people. I think it was also insecurities, you know, like a lot of shows, there are insecurities. I mean, I can't speak for what other people were going through in their minds. Again, even with my book, you know, again, it is fiction, but I'm writing from an experience through a very specific lens, and it would be kind of, you know, that POV. You know, you can't really, you know, show everything, but absolutely. It became a very uncomfortable scenario. And one of the things that I'll tell you, Danny, is, and I've never talked about this, and it actually makes me a little scared to talk about it. There is one thing that people don't know, and that is that after cycle 8, when we shot in Australia, I made the really difficult decision to actually leave the show. My contract was up. We had renegotiated like 4 at a time. I've never talked about this publicly ever. And I think it is important to talk about it now because, you know, people are starting to ask, well, if you were so uncomfortable, why didn't you leave? Why didn't you speak up? Well, I did leave. Wow. And and because Tyra and I had such a longstanding relationship, we had an agreement, you know, we'll never talk to our people, like agents and attorneys and all that stuff. So I reached out to her. You know, I take a deep breath as I say this.
Oh my God.
I reached out to her and I said, you know, I was now working on E! As a correspondent. I was hosting and executive producing Canada's Next Top Model and on another show for Style that I hosted. And I said, you know, it's really difficult schedule-wise, and I think I've done all that I can bring to the show. So I'm not going to renegotiate, you know, for another 4 seasons. And, you know, in the moment, she was very, you know, very calm. She just said, I'm very disappointed. That was it. Nothing else was said. And she probably had to process. I can look at it as an adult now and go, she had to process that because I know she really leaned on me and relied on me. And so she was, you know, upset. I mean, it was between seasons, so they had 3.5 months. I do know that they cast or tried to screen test some very, you know, notable fashion personalities to come on in creative direct. That being said, 2 weeks out of production for cycle 9, I got a call with from my then attorney. I was in the midst of changing teams and I was going to CAA, but I had a different attorney at the time, and he called and said, they're 2 weeks out of production. They couldn't find anyone to kind of fill my shoes. They asked if I could come back and do 1 season. Mm. Unfortunately, I had another job lined up, and I said, I don't think I can do it schedule wise. And he called me back 2 hours later. I'm having so much anxiety telling the story,
Jay.
But I mean, really, truly. So basically they said, and to summarize, basically they said, you know, they would really like it if I could come back and do 1 cycle because it was implied through the person telling me that I really might not be able to work for that major studio again if I could not. Was implied. So,
right.
And we know in the industry, we hear of all of these stories, especially with everything coming out now around blacklisting and this and that, which goes on.
Right.
And I was so afraid, you know, I'd had such a successful career in the business before going on TV, and I was really trying to transition. So it really put the fear, like serious fear in me, and I was scared. And so I canceled the other opportunity I was working on. I went back. I was assured everything would be fine. The producer spoke to me on the phone. They were like, this is great. You're back. Everything will be great. That was the cycle nine. We actually did the casting on a cruise ship. It was horrible to shoot on a cruise ship. I can't even tell you. And I
hate a cruise ship, by the way. Okay. Neither here. I hate a cruise ship. Go ahead.
But I showed up, and because of the taping and the timing of me getting there, I got there a day late. I normally do the welcome with Miss J. And I'm sorry if I'm telling you too much detail.
No, please.
There's so much anxiety around this.
No, I'm just loving listening. Go ahead.
Basically, I showed up. They'd already taped the welcome. So the first day of taping for all of us was, you know, the panel that we do. We do it over a series of days where we interview all the one of the 30 girls. Basically, I remember it like it was yesterday, to be honest with you. I walked in the room and I hadn't spoken to Tyra up until this point since I said I was leaving the show. So I knew it was going to be somewhat of an awkward moment, but everyone assured me everything was fine. The other producers, the other executive producers were lovely. I thought it was going to be normal. Oh, she walked in and I said, oh, I'm so glad we get a moment to talk before we shoot. And she kept walking. And I thought, maybe she didn't hear me, but I knew she heard me. I've never talked about this. And yeah, I was really kind of hurt and petrified all in one. I didn't want to be there. And I sat down. I tried to understand where she was coming from. I hadn't done anything that I felt to hurt her. She was clearly upset. She's also the executive producer, one of the executive producers on the show. She sat down next to me, and when they started rolling cameras, Tyra came alive. Mr. J, Miss J, blah, blah, blah. Everything was normal, and everything was normal on camera that whole season. But when the cameras turned off, she did not want to speak with me. And I'm like shaking telling the story because I thought I would never tell this story. And it's not in my book because my book, again, is fiction. But it was terrible. And I only ended up speaking with her 2 days before we shot. We were in China shooting at the Great Wall, where she was going to be the photographer. And I got a call to if I would come by her room to chat. And that's when we had a talk. And to be fair, she did say, you know, I have to apologize because I'm an executive producer here. You're talent on this show. Because that one-off cycle, I wasn't producing like I had before. And she said, I've been unprofessional. And she apologized. But from then on, it was just, it was uncomfortable. And we weren't who we were.
Right.
But we had to be who we were on camera because of what the fans knew. And that's the reality of that moment.
What strikes me is how upsetting it is just hearing you even so hesitant to talk about something like that, because I feel like so many people in so many different ways feel afraid to talk about something because of the power dynamics in a working environment, not only in television or film, but also throughout the world. Yeah. I was talking to a friend who works in a factory, and she was saying she had a similar experience where it was like the office, because there's the office and then there's the factory. And she said for years, she just felt like she couldn't tell her story at all. And I just think that's so common. And it makes me just so sad that even so many years later, somebody can feel powerless.
Honest with you, I've moved on from it. And as an adult, I mean, I'm 47 now, I can look and understand what she might have been going through. I mean, even when I was writing my characters in my book, I wanted them to be 360 characters and really dive into the psychology of why characters do what they do. And I actually interviewed a couple different psychologists and talk to them about some of this, you know, like what would someone really do if this is, or what's the reason why they're doing X or Y? And so I can look at that moment and be separate from it. I think what makes me a little nervous and anxious about it and is that I am telling it or speaking it out loud. And the reason I felt like I wanted to share with you is just the way the conversation was going. And I know people are trying to wrap their minds around why I wrote this book. Again, it's fun. It is satire. Sure. I poke fun at myself, even though the protagonist really isn't me. Parts of him are inspired by me. And, you know, but I realized even in publishing the book, and even when I was going out meeting with publishers, there was this level of anxiety of like, what's going to be the retribution? What's going to be the blowback? What's going to be, because there always was. There was always this idea of punishment. And I'm not the only one to say it. You can, there are so many producers, co-EPs who left the show. They feel the same way. It was not a great environment. But on the flip side, it was really a phenomenal ride to be a part of a global phenomenon. And there were magical moments and there sure. were great moments. It wasn't all terrible.
I mean, it's like a relationship, right? Like even a romantic relationship. You can look back and say there were these great, wonderful moments. And then there were also these awful moments. You posted on Instagram, actually, that through writing the book, you lost people close to you. Mm. Who were you referring to? People on the show or?
No, actually, I didn't. I recently posted that actually, yes. I think I also go on to say it's like writing a book is almost a form of quarantine. It really is. I did write the book myself. I had a great writing mentor, but I did not have a ghostwriter. And I had done writing when I was at NYU, but I by no means had a creative write, you know, bachelor's in creative writing or anything like that. And so I worked very hard on the writing, and I know I had to buckle down and lock myself away. So I'd say, you know, especially the end of 2018, beginning of 2019, or like in through to the summer, I literally would shut my phone off and have my alerts off on my computer, and I had to isolate to write. And it was amazing because I found myself, I found a level of joy and fulfillment I've never had. And that was really incredible. But there were friends and people close to me that didn't understand that. And I try to be there for people. And there were people who felt that I kind of abandoned them sure. in my process. And it was really sad and painful. They didn't fully understand it. And there's some relationships repaired, but it's still not 100% the same, which is sad.
You know, I'm a ghostwriter myself. I write books for other people. And it's a lot of work to write a book like this. So if you weren't working with a ghostwriter, like there's a lot of fucking words in a book and it's yes. a lot of time to do it. So I completely yeah. get it. And I don't think people understand, you know, oftentimes even just friends will be like, I have this idea for a book. And I'm like, you don't realize how many words are in a book. Like it's a book.
And then it's rewriting.
Right.
And writing really is rewriting. And right. what I ended up loving, to be honest with you, is when I would dive into every draft, I would be like renewed, reborn in some way. And you do things like character passes. Like I'm going to look just at Keisha's lines or Pablo's lines and the dialogue and really getting into those characters. And it's a lot of fun. And then you have to also go back and look at your, you know, narrative prose and that writing and how it does. Is that the voice that you want? And it took me a few drafts to find the voice I wanted for this book because I wanted it to be, kind of more of this generation. I didn't want it to read a little more classic. I don't know. I had to just find that voice. And I hopefully did a good job.
Yeah. And every time you change one little detail about a character, you have to go through and reread and rewrite the whole thing. It's like hours just yeah. to when you make one change. Okay. Yes. The book opens with a quote, your quote. It's, "The world of reality TV is not real, and yet reality television has morphed into reality. I've worked in this world of smoke and mirrors, and when the smoke dissipates, the mirror reflects the truth." I'm curious if you could explain that a little bit more and maybe what you learned about reality television and sort of the art of it or the or what you learned yeah. about it.
Well, that quote that I put right before chapter one, ultimately when one finishes the book, you realize that quote has several meanings, but the obvious being reality TV. We know, I think now pretty much, people know it's a product of careful editing, the right casting, the right scenarios. So it's not real. But what I was making a point of, which is a pretty kind of scary commentary on where we are as a society and looking at social media, because reality TV is really the birth mother of social media to an extent. And we now cover ourselves and shoot things. And it's like, here, I'm going to put out what is not me and love me for this. What does that do to the human spirit? And where's the truth in that? We're no longer sharing our truths. And then we're, you know, and before quarantine, you know, everybody was, you know, the stories and the pics and the this and that, and it was so orchestrated. Yeah. And so that's what I was saying. But beyond that, there's another layer, which is a reveal at the end of the book that kind of speaks to that idea of what's real and what's not. And we really need to start looking. It's kind of like in the Matrix film, that, you know, that whole analogy with Neo, are you looking at me or are you looking at the woman in the red dress and the training simulation? And we love to be titillated by the woman in the red dress. And we stop looking at what's real. And we have to get back to a point where we need to start looking at the real issues, which I think is what's coming out of this quarantine and all the civil rights issues right now, which need to be dealt with, because we're going to turn around and see that kind of gun of extinction almost turn back at us if we don't pay attention.
You know, I didn't have this question written down, so forgive me if it's a bit wordy, but this was one of the few, and America's Next Top Model is one of the few shows that was fronted by a Black woman. And you had mentioned you had seen some of the, earlier in the interview, you had mentioned something about seeing how Black women are treated in the industry. I'm curious.
Oh, it's one of the core themes in my book, which is looking at intersectionality in general and how the entertainment industry deals with Black women's identity within entertainment and television. Yes.
Right. So what did you learn about that? What can you share?
Well, kind of the way I frame it, you know, with my book, obviously Keisha Cash is a Black supermodel. And as a side note, you know, someone I really respected early on in this process had suggested that I make Keisha maybe Kirsten and make her white. Mm. You know, you don't want it to be too close. And I said, well, it's not about close or not close, because even your statement, that statement is actually racist, because Keisha is not Tyra. And now you're saying just because my character is Black, that means it's Tyra. That in itself is racist. And that's also saying that I can't have a Black antagonist. That was the same thing we used to do to women, you know, 10 and 15 years ago in television, you know, the anti-hero, the complex character, it was always reserved for straight white males. Women had to play the female role. And then we got great characters like, you know, Claire Underwood in House of Cards, where she could be complex and devious, or even Viola Davis as Annalise Keating in How to Get Away with Murder. You know, here's a woman, we loved her, she was powerful, she was amazing, and then we don't like her, then we don't trust her. But these complex characters, you can have a Black lead. And think of all of the amazing roles we're creating for actors if these get turned into films, et cetera, for Black actors. And that's how we have to not be afraid of being inclusive in that way. But to your original question there, around this idea of Black women's identity, and what I did with what I learned and what I did with Keisha is I wanted to show she's a diamond. She was created under pressure. She's a flawed diamond, but she was created under pressure, just how coal creates a diamond. And within an industry that's run predominantly by men, white men, and we're talking about the entertainment and fashion industry, and in the fashion industry specifically, when it comes to beauty and everything, not just fashion, but the beauty industry as well, everything's geared towards that white aesthetic. And what does that do? And how does that affect a Black woman within the industry trying to rise up, who has to kind of bridge, you know, be this kind of token of representing a group of individuals, but at the same time, bridging that gap to that white aesthetic? And what does that do psychologically in terms of understanding your worth? Because you're already told by an industry that you're subpar, but now you've got to be the leader in it. And I really, even though my book, again, is meant to be a lot of fun,
sure,
there is that subtext of like, hey, let's look at this, because it might also explain why people do what they do when they're put in a pressure situation, because what are they facing every day?
Right. It's so interesting. I was just having a conversation with a friend about representation and television specifically, but it kind of goes for all of the industries. And there's a new show on Netflix called The Babysitter's Club. And we were saying how it's, of course, based off the books from the 80s and 90s. But we were saying it's like, oh, now Hollywood will do a show about a group of young women. And then they'll say, okay, we have one show, so that's enough. And it's like... We give them one thing and that's enough. Yeah. And it's like, we need to have these representation. There isn't a limit to how many black women we should have on TV. Or
I mean, it's crazy. And to Tyra's credit, you know, she broke down. I mean, I will always respect her immensely for what she represents to so many. She was the first black woman on the cover of Sports Illustrated, you know, the first black woman, you know, to do several things. And even with this show, you know, no one expected it to become that global phenomenon. And, you know, it became a mainstream show where people didn't say, oh, well, there's a black supermodel. They have Miss J. They had me, which no one knew what I was, you know, it's like, but we were this diverse kind of panel of individuals, but we all worked in this business and it was accepted. So
huge. I mean, it's a huge accomplishment.
This episode of Everything Iconic is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. Now, I'm not sure if you've noticed, but it's definitely allergy season. You all know I've been struggling a little bit. I usually love the springtime, but I struggle with my allergies, which are just not the most fun. But luckily with Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, the only tissues I like to use, I can say, bring on the blooms, and I can face those allergies head on. Now, Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved, so you can attack watery eyes and battle runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. That's why I love these, because they're so incredibly soft, and I don't want to touch my nose with something that's not. Now, I am obsessed with Kleenex. I think they are so really just the best to do it. So for this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on. Again, this allergy season, do not pick up something else. Grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
I know I'm keeping you too long. I hope you don't mind.
I don't mind. I love chatting with you.
Okay, good. I have a couple of questions. So we have an Everything Iconic Patreon page, and so they sent in some questions. So Kim Jacob wants to know what your favorite photo shoot was throughout the years. Did you have a fave?
Gosh, this is so hard, and I'm going to forget probably so many of them. If I had to pick one of them, oh gosh, there's just so many I really enjoyed. It's like trying to pick which of your babies you love the most. You know what one was fun and super creative was the Zodiac shoot. It's just creatively, to me, it was really fun figuring out how to build those, you know, those concepts out. So I did love doing the Zodiac shoot and just the creative team I had around me, and they just saw the vision. It's so hard to choose. There are so many. What's your favorite?
I'm just thinking of all of the viral moments. That's what's coming into my mind of like what, and I'm curious, is there one that makes you laugh? Like the thing that's popping up in my mind is of course when Tyra like pretends she's sick and like faints, in front of
that wasn't a photo shoot.
Right. It wasn't a photo shoot, but I'm saying like, is there one like of those moment? Kind of moments that you see like in a meme or something that just makes you laugh or you have a good memory behind it? Of course, the Tiffany moment is what's shared all the time. But
yeah, a lot of people share the Jade in that commercial, the CoverGirl commercial where she had to ad-lib her whole way. And oh, right. She's just super crazy. There was that. But for me, one of the crazy moments was when we were supposed to do a makeovers reveal. I believe it's in cycle 11. Yes, cycle 11. And Tyra shows up to have a chat with the girls, having pizza and blah, blah, blah. And then she's going to tell them makeovers. But then in rolls Miss J looking like the evil witch. Like she goes, apples. And Tyra eats an apple like Snow White and faints. And then I come around the corner as a prince and a prince get up and I have to kiss her reviver and pick her up and carry her away. She was so afraid I was going to drop her. She's like, don't drop me. So I had to like pick her on the carrier out. That's like one of those corny moments where I'm like, oh God, we did that.
Some of those moments are so funny. Like I love when those clips pop up. Yeah. Emma Brumfield wants to know how much input you had in the makeover choices. You must have seen a bunch that you thought that was the wrong choice.
Mm-hmm. In the beginning, you know, everyone wanted our opinions, especially the first couple of seasons. And then they didn't really want our opinion so much on the makeovers. I absolutely spoke up when I didn't agree with something. There have been, and it was on camera. I mean, we talked very vocally about JL, you know, rest in peace. She's no longer with us, but she got this really bad weave and we just said right then and there, it's not working. This is terrible. It's awful. I called Tyra on the phone. You know, so sometimes you have to speak up. I mean, I just couldn't let some of them go by, and sure. Some of them you just kind of just stand there and just go with it.
Yeah, like what the hell happened? Did you watch the seasons after you left? Did you watch like the guy seasons? I remember they did.
I did not watch any of the seasons after cycle 18, and that's the honest answer. I had done 18 seasons of it. I produced on that show. I kind of felt, Again, that was a choice of mine to leave the show at cycle 18, which was misreported in the press at the time. But I kind of felt like watching it would kind of be weird for me emotionally.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Did you feel afraid to even speak up at that time when the press was reporting that?
Well, we weren't. Our contracts were very, very prohibitive. We weren't allowed to talk about it. I mean, even when I knew cycle 18, I was asked to renegotiate cycles 17, 18, 19, 20. I said I couldn't do it. I said I would do one. We settled on two. So that was 17 and 18. And I knew I wasn't going to go back for 19 or 20. But you think about when we shoot it in the fall and it airs in the spring, they don't want someone coming out saying, I left the show. So I wasn't supposed to say anything. We all agreed, and I'm going to say Tyra, Ken Mock, we all agreed we were on a conference call. We were going to do a joint press release. It was going to be an amicable parting, blah, blah, blah. And then there was a leak, which was all planted.
From production, probably.
Yeah, well, we kind of found out who. I won't throw that person under the bus. I have probably a little more class than that person did in action, because we found out actually who leaked that. But it was all to kind of create drama to say that Jay, myself, and Nigel were fired. But anyway, I just kind of felt like I didn't need to watch it after that and moved on.
Would you go back? I know there's been rumors about there being a 25th cycle. Is there any chance you would be like, yeah, I'll do that if they asked?
Well, I don't know if they'll ask. You know, my book, I think, has some people nervous. Again, it's fiction, but
they should, though. They need you back. They should do it.
You know, if it was a very different show, I don't think they can do the show the way it was. And I would love to be a part of something that's constructive, entertaining. But I think if the show was to come back pretty much like a version of what it was, I probably would not do it, unfortunately. Because, yeah.
I know you had mentioned in the press you and Tyra haven't spoken. I believe you said you had emailed in 2017, but that was about it.
I saw her in person in 2017, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
She emailed me right after, yeah.
Will you reach out at all now that the book's out? Do you think she might reach out? Like, do you think you guys could reconcile a little bit more?
She has not reached out to date. Since my book is announced, I'm assuming she knows about it. It's kind of been talked about kind of around the world. You know, if she wanted to talk about it, I'd love to. You know, the book is not written from any place of malice or negativity. I really do respect and care about her well-being still to this day. But I don't know. Things there were so many kind of weird and uncomfortable moments, even post that whole cycle. I went back cycle 9, and then obviously I went back to the show for a period after. There were some other really uncomfortable moments. So I don't really know if we can have kind of the relationship we had before. I'm not sure of that. I mean, if we could really talk and communicate, maybe, but who knows? I don't know if that's a real possibility.
Right. Well, Jay, I just finally have some lightning round questions for you. These are real easy, just pop culture related. What's your favorite rom-com?
Notting Hill.
Oh, a classic. I'm just a boy, or I'm just a girl standing in front of a boy. Oh, so
asking
good.
Asking him to love me.
Is that not the best? It's the best.
Best line.
Brittany or Christina?
Oh my God, are you kidding? Oh, Christina.
Yeah. Madonna or Cher?
Madonna.
Favorite Mariah Carey song?
Hero.
Classic.
Of course,
Do you have an all-time favorite book besides your own?
Novel or nonfiction?
Either or. Or maybe like a childhood book, something that you loved as a kid.
Well, The Giving Tree was the kid. This is the book I loved as a kid. And as an adult, it really, the book that changed my life was Eckhart Tolle's A New Earth. I actually wrote him after I read that book and he responded and it was profound. It was profound.
I love that. If you were choosing People Magazine's Sexiest Man Alive, who would you choose?
Oh my God. Today? Sexiest Man Alive. There's just... Oh my God, that's hard.
like an actor or musician or?
Well, it usually is an actor, right? Or it has been a musician in the past. So Sexiest Man Alive, who hasn't been the sexiest man alive before? That's hard. Oh gosh. Well, I kind of have two, but I don't
throw
know.
Them at me. Throw them at me. Who are they?
So they're kind of two. I guess they're both. They're very telling because they're like quasi crushes of mine. So I'm like totally blowing myself up right here. So I would say Idris Elba or Patrick Wilson. Either or.
Both are fantastic
options. Don't you think both of them would be great? Maybe we do a tie.
Did you? I just rewatched the movie Little Children. He is like stunning in that. I mean, he's stunning all the time, Patrick Wilson, but like in that movie.
Oh, I know. Did you rewatch like the laundry room scene specifically?
Of course. Yeah.
Of course.
Saved on my computer, that scene.
Yeah. You kind of have to pause on that scene.
who's the greatest, who do you think is the greatest model of all time? Like, is there one model that you think, not from top model necessarily, but just a classic supermodel?
Classic supermodel of all time. Wow. That's a really, really, really hard question. I mean, and there's just so many brilliant women supermodels. I'm going to just say, maybe because she's a fellow Canadian and I watched her rise, was Linda Evangelista, one of the big supermodels. I'm going to say her because she grew up not that far from me. And before she was Linda Evangelista, she used to have long hair. And I used to see her in like there's a department store called The Bay and they had like ads with her like early on in her career before she broke. And so to see her go on the national stage like that, and she was like epic. So I used to love her. I still do.
Kelly Catrone, thoughts? I love her. I know you just did an interview with her. I'm obsessed with Kelly Catrone.
Kelly is, she's a lot of fun. I mean, I love how, you know, she comes off like she's abrasive and cold and this and awkward, kind of like Wednesday Addams, you know, all in black. But you know what? I've had some really, really great times with Kelly Catrone where she's invited me to an event that she was, you know, putting on. And Kelly really has this big, big heart. She really does have a big heart. And I love how she can just be like truly just be herself with you. And she's just no nonsense. So she's no bullshit. So
I miss her presence on TV because I feel like she, more than anyone else from television history, I feel like she's the best at being no nonsense. And I just want her to like yell at
keeping
me.
Keeping it real.
Right. She's great on a judging panel. Yeah. Jay, this was so fun. I want to encourage everyone to get the book, The Meltdown. I might be backwards, but everyone needs to get it. I can't wait to read it. I haven't read it yet. I'm so excited to dive in. And I thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us.
Thank you.
Where can people find you on social media?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram. I'm Mr. J Manuel, MR JAYMANUEL. And on Facebook, J Manuel Official. And yeah, everything about my book, The Wig, the Bitch, and the Meltdown is on my website, which is just jmanuel.com. And the book is available everywhere books are sold.
And is there an audiobook as well?
It is in the works.
Oh my God, so exciting.
It is in the works, which is exciting. So that is in the works right now.
Well, Jay, thank you so much for stopping by Everything Iconic. I want to encourage everyone to subscribe, like, comment on the YouTube channel. And then thank you to everyone who's subscribing on the podcast. I love you guys. Jay, thank you. Congratulations on the book. It's such a huge accomplishment. I know it's so much work. Tell those friends who are pissed at you, fuck off, because it's a lot of work to write a book.
It is.
Thank you so much, Jay. Bye-bye.
There's no turning back, no, no, it's all-